Cynthia Alvey, 420, 1961.
Okay, Cynthia, welcome to the project Life During the Pandemic in Kentucky. As I explained to you earlier, this is a project basically to record the experiences of people who have lived through this pandemic. And to develop an archive so that years from now, historians and other analysts can go in and get people's personal experiences, just regular people. You know, you're going to have probably the president will be on, but anyway, you know, a lot of people that are VIP types, but I think it's important to have the story, especially healthcare workers, to have that archive. So, Cynthia, I'm going to ask you, who were you and what were you doing? What was your life like prior to your knowledge of the seriousness of the COVID epidemic or pandemic?
Okay. I think my job role at the time, I was executive director of quality and education for Owensboro Health, regional health system in Owensboro, Kentucky. And I'm a wife and a mother. I have two grown children and had two grandchildren. One was born right before the pandemic really got recognized in the United States. Mm-hmm. So when the first case in Kentucky, the week that the first case in Kentucky was reported, I was in Lexington attending a quality conference and had visited UK Healthcare to network with some people there. And at the end of the quality conference, I drove to Louisville, stopped at my daughter's house, and for about an hour to see the new baby. He was only 4 weeks old. I think it was March 6th or 7th. And then I drove home to Owensboro. And by the time I got to Owensboro, the mayor of Lexington was on the news reporting that they had their first COVID case in the critical care area at UK Med Center.
Wow.
I realized the seriousness of it when we were hearing reports from China, from mm-hmm. Wuhan. And infection preventionists were part of my area in quality. And so I think we were sort of in a waiting and expectant mode. And it was not, I think that week, within the next week in my job role, I became aware of the state health department quarantining people in the Owensboro area. So it began because you have people who travel, you know, because of travel.
Right.
So I was made aware of the first person in our, I guess our region for service that was actually kept in quarantine to assure that that they weren't spreading it. But of course, it just exploded after that.
Yeah, really. So how did your life change abruptly? What were you having to do? And you can bring that all the way up to now if you like.
Okay. I think the biggest change, how my life changed abruptly, was that my job with the health system I was working for, all typical activities almost immediately came to a stop while we as an organization decided what steps we needed to take to begin to address this. And I was put on a committee pretty quickly of organizational leaders that took different roles and tasks, and we began to work on those tasks. So my job, I did a lot less of my normal activities, and what I was doing was helping multiple departments develop a process, the processes that we would use for an outpatient drive-through COVID testing clinic.
Yeah.
So we were out finding the building. We identified locations where we could do this and sort of envisioned how that would happen, that we could provide this service in the community, and identifying the people who would man it. How would we run it? How would we take, you know, because as things heated up and we stopped providing, you didn't do elective surgeries anymore. You were only doing emergence. So how could we pivot and utilize staff members who weren't doing elective procedures? Because some people, some organizations were actually laying people off for a while.
Where you work actually laid some people off. Yeah. Or furloughed.
Yeah. Furloughed people. People were not able to work their authorized hours, and that created financial hardship. So we were trying to shift their work hours into things that were needed that weren't their usual job roles.
Yeah.
And then that presented us challenges as I think at the end of May, early June, the governor started to, once we had guidelines in place to reduce transmission, you know, everything that had to be done, figuring out how we were going to have people to be the screeners and how we were going to have people masked and, people coming into the facility, how we were going to restrict visitors and family and how to, it was a total stop of normal activities to figure out how we were going to do these things. And then after a number of weeks, when the governor then said, you can resume elective procedures if, at the state government said, if you do these things, then we had to figure out how to do that and move people back into job roles and still keep our services that we now created with a COVID testing clinic going. So all of that, I would say mid-March through the end of June, that was my primary job role was working on assuring we had testing and that we networked with like local outpatient surgery center. We just didn't have, the turnaround time was long. It was difficult. I think the big thing is you just did not have the supplies to do the test. Plenty of swabs. Yeah. But the actual reagents that the laboratory needed to process, swabs and to be able to perform tests was a challenge.
PPE adequate?
It was a challenge. It was a challenge. When we were, especially the N95s, that was a big challenge. Gowns also became a challenge at one point in time. So lots of review, you had to constantly be looking to the CDC website and the state website. The volume of reporting and duplicate reporting for the federal and the state level was a constant struggle for infection preventionists. Our infection preventionist, two full-time nurse FTEs for that. It was a 7-day a week commitment.
Wow.
And they weren't there, all day, Saturday and Sunday, but it was 24 hours a day of call as well. So they were on call and it was very intense. And in the middle of all that, I ended up finding out about a job opportunity in Louisville, and I wanted to relocate to Louisville because my adult children were here. My mother-in-law, my husband and I had planned to do it when we reached a point that we were able to do that. He was retired. So I did interviews by Zoom, never met anybody in person, and was hired to a new job. So it was a very interesting experience. So,
yes, I can imagine.
Yeah. I really liked the opportunity. I enjoyed the opportunity of working. I was accustomed to working with multiple hospital departments anyway, but it gave me an opportunity to work with many different departments to create the workflows and the processes that enabled us to do community COVID testing and support that.
Are you talking about Owensboro now or Louisville?
Yes, that was in Owensboro.
Yeah.
In Louisville.
What is the state of the art hospital? I have to say it's a beautiful hospital.
It is a very nice hospital, and they do some things quite well there. I think their safety program is really very, very good.
Yeah.
So
you came to Louisville. So then you came to Louisville. Are you doing almost the same thing in Louisville that you did in Owensboro?
My job in Louisville is not as broad in scope. I work for a much larger health system here. Yes. It's about four times the size, has five hospitals, four adult, one pediatric. And I am a quality director in one of the smallest facility in the system. So it's not as, it's not, I don't have nearly the breadth of responsibility or the scope that I had in Owensboro. It's just different. And it's a different way of approaching quality. So, but
well, and maybe as you, I'm not saying you're going to age out, but as you look toward that eventually, maybe that's kind of how you need to do it.
Yeah, that was in the plan. I have about 5 years of, mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that I won't work part-time beyond that, but I probably right. have about 5 years of a career left. Mm-hmm. And it was a thought that I could sort of manage a transition to a different city where mm-hmm. I really wanted to be in a locale, but also sort of back off a little.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
And the health system I'm with now, I must say, very good structure and lots of system level support. The infection prevention support in this system and their approach to handling things in the pandemic is very, very good.
Yes.
Very good.
Well, I can just speak for the communication with patients, especially the MyChart stuff, that it's really good. I really like to be able to communicate with my healthcare providers. Not that I do a lot, but it's if you need to, it's right there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's and Owensboro was an epic facility as well, and so a lot of similarities in the tools mm-hmm. That are used. So I don't see problems with PPE in the Louisville area. I think there was a time for most facilities. We were very happy in Owensboro when we realized the FDA had approved reprocessing of N95s. And you constantly had to be with the CDC website and the state to kind of put together the changes. I think early on in the pandemic, that was the big challenge, was to try to stay up to date, because we were, as we learned, things had to change. And so yes. What people were taught to do or told to do a couple of weeks prior may change. And yeah. I think that's difficult, especially when you're communicating with thousands of people. To get the message out and make it look like, and I guess not have the perception that, well, you never knew what you were doing
mm-hmm.
because we were doing with the best we had with the information that was being provided at the time.
Yeah.
You know, and what I'm glad to see over the course of the pandemic, and especially the health system I'm with now, I'm able to see that from the data there. It's very data rich. Clinical analytics is phenomenal. But we are able to see that as the pandemic has gone on over time, the number of people that actually need to be, though the numbers are increasing of people with COVID, the numbers in critical care have you know, declined in proportion. You have not as many people in critical care. So what that says to me is that we have learned, as medical healthcare providers have learned over better how to treat better earlier, possibly prevent that progression to more severe disease in some people. And so it's, you know, we don't have any fears or concerns of being not having enough ICU beds, not having yes. enough ventilators. And in the early days when I was in Owensboro, that was very much a fear statewide.
Yeah. You know. Because you all opened extra units, didn't you, for COVID?
In Owensboro?
Yeah.
We took, that organization took an observation unit, a patient observation unit yes. that was meant for short stays to determine if you really needed inpatient admission. They took that unit and made that a COVID unit for the non-critical care patients.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Debbie, if you've probably talked with other people from yeah. that area about how they also utilized a rehab unit.
Yes.
For actually prisoners, people, because you had correctional facilities, large correctional facilities. Yes. And once you have it in, you know, COVID in a congregate care, you know, a congregate living situation, you do have spread. And so that facility really had to be able to meet the needs of the prison system, a large prison system located in their service area. So, and they did it quite well.
Yeah. I mean, really, you've got a lot more tools in your toolkit, places, ways to avoid putting a tube in people and putting them on the respirator, I'm understanding,
yeah,
which is everybody's greatest fear, I think.
I think you're right. It's, yeah. It was difficult. I think some of the difficulties that I saw is the human interaction. Just some of the things that people had to do in order to reduce PPE use, try to conserve, I should say,
yeah.
to conserve PPE, because there were things that were difficult to get.
Yeah.
And so, you know, extending the IV tubing, you know, IV tubings with many extension sets so that IV pumps could be outside the room, so that if some adjustment had to be done, the nurse didn't have to enter the room, and things that you typically, that, you know, that was a whole different, you know, yeah. concept for critical
what
care.
What a learning curve.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think at the time in Owensboro, when I was in Owensboro, I actually had responsibility for the pastoral care department as well. Mm-hmm. So the pastoral care director, who was relatively new, she would have, was like about only 6 months into her tenure when the pandemic hit. She really began to try to focus on the needs of the critical care nurses, and began to regularly, even though they always had a pastoral care team member dedicated up there for patients, she began to be there regularly for nurses.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the stress of caring for the patients and the families, and having the families not being able to be there. And it was hard on clergy in the community.
Oh, because, I can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it was hard on the priest who was assigned to that. He had difficulty. I think I perceive that he had difficulty understanding the significance of this and yes. why these restrictions were necessary. Very hard, very yeah. hard. But that director of pastoral care there, she began to extend herself very intentionally to develop relationships with the nurses in that critical care area and the leaders of those areas, because it was very, very, very difficult for them.
Yes, I can imagine. One, it's just hard for me to imagine being with patients as they die, and they die alone, and you're the only link to the outside world. What a responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just, I mean, people are, it'll be a long time if everybody gets over that, I would say.
Yeah. The American Nurses Association has produced a good number of webinars trying to, and made them free to even nurses who are not members. And I've been doing a lot of those just to really educate myself more about the pandemic. It's part of my educational process as well, because I'm enrolled in a program. So mm-hmm. I was, they actually have a number of webinars to designed to sort of lead nurses through self-care and talking about the impact of this on of participating in patient care during the pandemic, that they can expect this to leave lasting effects for the yeah. people who've worked in direct care. So
exactly. So how about your family, Cynthia? How are they weathering it?
Pretty well. My husband is somebody who would fall into a high risk category. He's over 60 and has hypertension and type 2 diabetes, though well controlled. We laugh and call him the original social distancer, because he pretty much kept to himself a lot anyway. But we're very careful. I go to work, and most of my work day is on Zoom meetings. Mm-hmm. I am masked at work. If I go into a patient care area, which I do go out to round on patients, mm-hmm. In a sort of a patient satisfaction or patient experience manner to mm-hmm. talk with them, I wear eye protection over my glasses as well as masks.
Mm-hmm.
My husband primarily goes out to the grocery store. We do not do a lot of shopping, of course. We make mm-hmm. sure our vehicles are stocked with masks and hand sanitizer. I think one of the biggest changes for me is doing, I guess, my church involvement online. So worship services are now an online event. But we also, one of the reasons for being in Louisville is our mothers. I have a mother who's 80, who is widowed, lives alone, and does have, she has health issues that put her at high risk category, as does my husband, whose mother is 89.
So they're both here.
So they're both in their own homes, and we, you can't keep my mother out of the, of living. She's going to drive her car. She's going to go get her own groceries. She's going to go to things, but it's really very limited. So our contact is very limited. We're masked. We, you know, we use hand sanitizer religiously, and we try to limit involvement with family members who might have more contact in the community, so that we can see our mothers. And I have a niece who's a college student, and I have only been around her once, I would say, in the last 5 or 5 months or so. And of course she was masked, and I was masked. We try to do family events when the weather is nice, outdoors on driveways. Often with masks. We have determined that our social bubble is really my daughter, who is right now staying at home with two small children. She was a physical, she is a physical therapist, but her services were not as needed. With volume. My son-in-law is a GI fellow, so he is in the healthcare field, and he, of course, he's masked at work and following all precautions. But we've had a number of, they've had a number of potential exposures where they then had to separate themselves, and we observed, and of course, CDC guidelines have changed, but right now it's 10 days if there's no symptoms at all. I have been tested once for COVID because I had a coworker who was positive. I was never around her without a mask on. But I developed a sore throat and was tested. I was negative. I isolated myself just for like 3 days. I was negative. There was, it was, it wasn't, I wasn't ill with COVID.
Did you get the vaccine yet?
I did. I received the vaccine on, it's been a week and 2 days. So I got the Moderna. And my son-in-law got it probably 2 weeks before I did. And he had the Pfizer vaccine. I have two of my a sister-in-law and a brother-in-law who are anesthesiologists. They've had their first dose. Actually, getting one of them got their second today. There are a lot of healthcare people in our extended family. And I think all of us save one, because they're there are three. There's a physician in Indianapolis. He's a hospitalist. He was in the heat of it. It was awful.
What hospital is he?
He was at St. Vincent's in Indianapolis. And he said his observation was that he thought Kentucky was doing a much better job than Indiana. And he had rough, he had a rough time. He was pretty much an inpatient unit, became a COVID unit. He was managing the patients there. And if you were above a certain age, you just weren't going to get a critical care bed.
It was,
I mean, it was, we don't think that rationing happens or triage in original sense. You're a former IC nurse, you know, it had to happen. And, I can't imagine, I am very thankful. The governor of Kentucky, I think, has done, part of your questions were, how do you think we've done politically, or has it been politicized? You know, it's very real. And I never doubted for a moment that this was a very real infection, and it was an issue. I admire what the governor of the state of Kentucky has done and the steps that he took, and the public, the role of public health in this state.
And he's gotten a lot of blowback.
Yes, he has. And I appreciate that he is collaborative. There is a Republican governor in Ohio who he collaborated with. And we, I lived in Ohio for 6 years. I have a sister-in-law there. So I was really, I was really happy about that. I would like to see more collaboration.
Well, I
Very
mean, I'm not trying to make a political statement, but maybe when Biden comes in and there'll be more of a national effort, you'll see that coordination rather than the states being left to their own to compete with each other.
It is this pandemic, of course, and I'm, you know, it really highlights the lack of a true system,
yeah,
a healthcare system in the United States.
Yeah,
and yeah, we're a loose association of states and the federal government when it comes to health and public health in particular. It highlighted our real weaknesses.
Yeah, I think England with their national health services, those sorts of things, just yeah,
yep,
yeah.
Yeah, I am hopeful that we evolve a
yeah.
little bit so that we can address that. This,
I agree.
Shows us where our big weaknesses are.
Indeed, it does. So, well, really, every time I watch the show, Call the Midwife, and those women they're basically, oh my gosh, they're using the National Healthcare Services in its infancy to save babies. I just, you know, when anybody raises it, this is why we need nationalized healthcare.
they're, you know, I don't think people really study it.
Yeah.
And therefore, they're not aware of those gaps.
Yeah.
And I had an advanced epidemiology course last year, and it really opened my eyes.
Yes. Yes. I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of politicization, you think that I'm sure you think the pandemic has been politicized. You've already said as much. Do you think that defeated President Trump?
No, not that alone. No, I don't.
I mean, we have to remember it wasn't all that. I mean, he did get a lot of votes. So
yeah, I don't think that alone did it. You know, I wanted Anthony Fauci to be person of the year, but
I did too.
I think science, you have to keep pressing on with the science, you know,
yeah.
What, you know, the science behind what it is that we need to do for this. So really don't think that was the only, it might've been part of the downfall, but, I think it was a lot broader than that.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, and so in terms of the local level in Davis County, and you can talk about it here too, if you like, how do you think the local levels have handled it?
You know, in Owensboro, and maybe this is my ignorance about the local level there, the hospital was such a force in that community,
mm-hmm.
That I think I sense that they were just the local officials. They had two things they had to do. They had to listen to the state, what the governor had to say, and what the state health department said, and look to Owensboro Health to help yeah. them. And that hospital, that health system, you know, I was with them for 26 years. Actually, I had 32 years of service because I had worked for a Mercy Health System in Ohio mm-hmm. and transferred into Mercy in Owensboro and,
yeah.
you know, growth and change and merger and all that.
Yeah.
So that health system had resources going out in the community as the state issued the guidelines for, you know, temperature taking and masking and all of that stuff. They had to have screeners to let people come to work. Owensboro Health was providing those people to do it and paying them to do it.
Wow.
I mean, that is the health system there, the hospital and the health system is a huge economic engine for
yeah.
that part of the country. And that it was basically a national news item that there were three towns or cities in the U.S. that were having an economic boom with COVID and Owensboro, Kentucky. Owensboro was one of them. So I think they did well. And I think they did as well as they could, really.
How was the compliance there in terms of social distancing and masking?
Well, you have to remember, I didn't go very many places.
Yeah.
I saw most people. I did limited trips to groceries, and only out in the summer, maybe some outdoor dining. We were very careful about it, though. I saw pretty good compliance. But I think part of that was the businesses in Owensboro and people who would say they had somebody at the door that would say, you must have a mask to come in. Oh, I forgot my mask. And people would go back to their cars and get them. So I saw some of the national chain stores probably start that. And I just wasn't frequenting places where people were a little belligerent or obstinate about it. I thought, as a general rule, most of the community was doing a pretty good job. And here where we live in Louisville, of course, we live in a you know, it's a pretty affluent area and end of town, and it appears that most people cooperate.
I mean, it's about education, I think, a lot in a lot of ways too. So
And we did have people who were angry. I remember people who did not want to isolate. That was an issue. People, once we began doing elective surgical procedures and they needed to have their COVID swab done within a very narrow time frame, of course, but even with the turnaround, they had to self-isolate sometimes as much as 3 or 4 days before they came to the hospital for a procedure. And we had patients go through our drive-through testing who, with their instructions as to what they were to do, which they'd heard them before. They'd heard them when they were registered. They would tell us they weren't going to do it. And they didn't realize we knew exactly who they were and who their ordering physician was. And we began, our chief medical officer began calling those physicians, and physicians would call those patients to say, unless you follow these instructions, I will not perform your surgery.
Well, that's the way it ought to be, really.
So we were able to head some of that off. And I don't understand the skepticism, really. And there's skepticism within our extended family. My daughter had to have a COVID test done before she had an outpatient procedure, diagnostic procedure. And she had an adult cousin who said, why were you being tested? I wouldn't want to feed into their data. And my daughter,
I've heard that before too. It's just astounding, isn't it?
My daughter looked at her and said, to be able to go into a healthcare facility to have a procedure, they have to make sure that you're not going to bring it in.
Yeah.
there are people who just still don't believe it and don't alter their behavior much.
Well, and it's just too, that's it's so politicized. It's the dividing line right now. You know, if you wear a mask, you're like self-identifying as on one side of the divide, or if you don't wear it, you're on the other. And it's crazy that it's gotten that way.
Yeah. I'm because we keep our bubble very small. I think one thing that's hard for us is our son works in a very high risk industry. He's a safety manager in a plant. It's a meat processing plant. And he works night shift because his job is really with the company that's the vendor that cleans the place.
Yeah.
And so he said, you know, they started putting the safety measures in place there. Of course, it was very, very publicized about the problems in meat processing plants in the spring with the pandemic. And I think locally he was aware of maybe five. I don't know if there were five, there were over 30 people, I think, or 60 people total, but I think there were 5 deaths.
Wow.
I think that I have it right. So he became ill very early after going to work there. He's young and very healthy. But he moved from Tennessee, which, you know, has been awful with the pandemic.
Awful.
And he moved to Louisville at the end of January, right before the pandemic hit, and began his job in early February. And he had to go for training in Des Moines, Iowa. And he was in a training facility with people from all over. Maybe it's Davenport, small town in Iowa. And he was there with people from all over the United States who were sent for training. And he came back, and within about a week, he woke up, he realized he had was running a fever, or yeah, he had a temperature, and ended up having to, it was before testing really became the thing to do.
Yeah.
So he was symptomatic for about four or five days. Of course, he had to go see a provider. They gave him good instructions. He had to mask. We made a trip into Louisville and dropped off bags of supplies for him at his door. Mm-hmm. And he got over it rather quickly. But there was nothing, there's no way to, he appears to have had the symptoms, probably had it, but nothing's recorded that says that he did. So he tries to keep himself, he's very careful about coming around us. We do see him occasionally in the winter. It's we see him with a mask on, even in the house. Don't spend a lot of time with him. He has an odd work schedule, so it's difficult. But he's been very isolated.
Yeah.
Very isolated.
Yeah. Wow.
He wants a cat now. I think that's how isolated he is. He needs a cat.
Well, are you having much experience with anti-vaxxers?
I am surprised.
Among healthcare workers.
Yes. And that's what I'm surprised about. One of our relatives, another anesthesiologist, I was texting him and said, hey, have you gotten the vaccine yet? Because two of the other family members that are in the same group had. And he said, you know, I never get sick.
Oh my gosh.
And I thought, are you kidding? So I sort of made light of it, but his rationale was maybe I need to wait until other people have gotten it, which, you know, I felt a little guilty about taking it because I'm not in the front line, but,
he's intubating people though, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. He's actually pretty specialized. He's, as anesthesia has changed over the years and CRNAs do so much of it under under anesthesiology supervision, he actually is a niche. He does lots of cardiac procedures. So where they want an anesthesiologist. So yeah,
that's pretty frontline.
Yeah. He is. He's very frontline. So, but he, within about a week, I got another text from him and he had taken it. So I was glad to hear it. We have one nurse in the family who is a young woman, and she indicated, I think through family discussion, it was indicated she was worried about taking it, didn't think she was going to take it because of the false information about infertility. She struggled with infertility and has had one child, and it was very long road for her and difficult. And I think there's been enough false information circulating that it's going to affect fertility in young females. So I hope that the real science has been made more public now. So I'm hoping that she's read that because she works in a hospital setting.
Are they going to require healthcare workers to have the vaccine in order to work?
For the organization in which I work, it is not mandatory. Mm-hmm. However, Norton Healthcare has been very, very generous with their employees. And if you had to be quarantined, if you were ill with COVID, even if you did not have enough flex time, you know, ill and vacation time combined, if you did not have enough flex time, they're paying people and they're not counting it as against their earned benefit time off.
Right.
It's over and above that.
Yeah.
But now that the vaccine is available, if you choose not to take the vaccine and you become ill with COVID, then you will have to use your benefit time that you have accrued.
Yeah.
Because you made a choice. So as I understand.
Actually pretty generous, I think.
Yes. And they've done a lot of work with people for work from home, which Owensboro Health did too, to keep people isolated. Mm-hmm. They also, I think the most recent information that I read today is that by this weekend, Norton Healthcare will have vaccinated 10,000 employees.
Wow. And
I think they have between 16 and 17,000. Mm-hmm. So they're now beginning to spread it out, still staying in that 1A tier that's the recommended by the state or designed by the state. It's now going to people, being offered to people who work in offices and clinics.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's very good. I think I what I've been surprised about, I asked a friend in Owensboro about how I thought I'd seen some information on social media that about half of the workers there had received the vaccine. And I was told that there are a lot of people who weren't taking it. They seem to want to wait. And I had to do a lot of literature review because I have one drug allergy. Uh-huh. And what I am allergic to is not the drug itself, right, but some of the contents, the ingredients. Yes. And yeah, so I had to do a lot of digging because my allergic reaction was very severe and required a hospitalization 5 years ago. So I did a lot of investigation before I took the vaccine, and I pre-medicated before I took the vaccine.
Oh, that's a good idea. So you didn't really have any significant effects?
No, a sore arm, no big deal. Day and a half of a sore arm, no problem.
Yeah. My daughter's a resident at Raleigh up in Indianapolis, and the first vaccine, it was Pfizer, nothing, just a sore arm, but she was really kind of sick with the booster, actually, and it was a call night, so.
Oh, gee, that's what I was saying. If you can plan it, you want to plan to take a vaccine when you can be off a couple of days, because, the Shingrix vaccine, 50% of the people that take will knock them on the rear end. They may miss a couple of days of work.
Exactly.
So the side effects. But it means your immune system's working. So it's doing its job.
Well, exactly. And you're all lucky that you got the vaccine and you all deserve it. I'm thrilled about that.
Yeah.
Has anything good happened to you as a result of the pandemic?
I don't know if it's as a result of, in spite of, I got a new job and moved to be closer to family, which in the time of the pandemic is particularly helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I wondered about the timing of it. I thought, what a time to start a new job. I just
made it really.
Mm-hmm. And you know, your orientation and training, everything's different. It's not the same. But it's allowed us to be here and far more present to be of assistance to others, you know, so that if my mother-in-law or my mother can't get out to do something, we can. And, you know, it's just it. So I think that's a good thing. I don't know that it's not because of the pandemic, but in spite of it, and that it worked out. It's a good time. So,
I don't know. Well, you've not been here for long enough to really see it, but the racial unrest that's taken the upswing in that. Do you think that's in any way related to the pandemic?
I don't think as it initiated, I don't think that was. However, the racial disparities in care, it sort of highlights, and I saw this in Owensboro too. Our immigrant population, we had in that community, COVID ran rampant through it.
Yeah.
So when you have people who may be living in multi-generational households,
right,
closer proximity to each other, they can't quarantine, they don't have multiple bathrooms in their facility, in their living spaces, those groups are at a big disadvantage.
Yeah.
And this highlighted that for me. I mean, we in Owensboro, it was a lot of the immigrant population were working in chicken processing and meat processing plants. And they were in a panic. They were calling our testing center. I was getting calls from the chief medical officer of our organization, or I guess he was VPMA. He was vice president of medical affairs. And he's like, okay, Cynthia, how can we run 900 people through in one day in addition to what we're doing?
And wow.
And I would say, okay, I need to talk to Rhonda, who's really supervising this, and we can come up with a plan. They wanted to know if we would come there. They were shutting down plants to disinfect. And it was these poor people. They didn't understand. They were wearing a mask at work. And then they all piled into the same van to go home and took their masks off.
Yeah.
You know, they had one form of transportation. They were all together. They were living. We were printing out things in their language to try to give them instructions, and then finding out they were not literate in their own language.
Yeah, that's true.
So we were collaborating with the health department. So not just the racial unrest in Louisville, but I think I don't think that the racial unrest that happened here was spurned by, you know, I don't think it was precipitated by the pandemic.
Right.
But I think that the pandemic certainly makes it more obvious that the disparities, how they impact those groups.
Well, and people's stress level go up when they're going to be evicted, or they don't know where their next meal to feed their children is going to come from. Yeah. And then they're home watching, you know, George Floyd and that loop that was so horrible. You know, I think that's sent a lot of people out to the streets too.
I think that, and the groups that, of course, the group where the most of the mortality has happened, the older adults and the long-term care facilities. And that's a personal interest of mine as a nurse. That's my area of focus for my research project that I did this year, is older adults and aging, and nurses' knowledge base about them as they come out of their licensure programs. And I've done I do a lot of listening to webinars and podcasts on older adults and aging. And a lot of the COVID related education that's been happening, and the isolation and the loneliness for those elders who are in the community, are in their home, not even the ones that are in long-term care facilities that were so much at risk, but it's really difficult. And for many of them, it's either their family or their faith communities, and those things have all changed. And if you're an older adult and you don't have a computer or somebody to help you Zoom, help you get set up to Zoom or Duo or whatever, to be able to have some interaction, it's really limiting. And I think, a big risk factor for depression. And I feel so sorry for, there's been the deaths that have occurred during this, COVID related and not, the restrictions on, the traditional ways that people grieve, and the ability, and I worry about the funeral homes. My goodness, these people, not only are the hospital workers exhausted, the people in funeral homes are exhausted.
Oh, I could imagine.
When you look at the amount of work that they're having to do. And even with that, there was a funeral home in Owensboro, Glenn Funeral Home, that was making, they had the equipment and were able to make face masks. They were making face masks for the hospital.
Wow.
They were making face masks for the healthcare workers. They worked with them to make intubation boxes to see if it would be helpful to the people who had to do intubation to protect them.
I need to talk to somebody in that side of the equation, really. I think I need to get somebody.
I could reach out to Glenn Taylor. I used to be on the hospice board with him, and he went to my church. So if you want,
I really do. I don't want to interrupt your story too much, but that would really be wonderful if you could do that, because I think that is something that belongs in the archive.
I will reach out, because it was, I think I can connect back to him and see if he might be willing to talk with you.
Super. Yeah.
I will share this with our nurse leadership group at Norton Brownsboro to see if there are frontline ICU nurses that might want to participate.
Yes. And anybody feels like they want their story in this, I mean, please tell them to contact me, because again, I'm going to be interviewing for the long haul, really. All right, 1,500 years from now, when analysts are looking at your archives and trying to get a handle on how we handle this, what do you think their assessment will be?
I think they'll question our health system. why it didn't make sense for us earlier to have a coordinated, to be prepared for this. You know, when one of the things that I had to do in my the program that I'm in at Western, in my advanced epidemiology course, we read the John Barry book on the 1918 influenza, the great influenza.
Oh, that's a fabulous book.
It was really good, and it was amazing, and yet we didn't learn all the lessons we should have. And to know that there actually, a previous president had read the book, had established a commission, and then it had been dissolved.
Yes.
And additional work had not been done. So I just don't know why people, I don't know why at the, that wasn't, I guess, attended to. It had been identified as a risk.
Yeah.
There had been work done, and they just didn't go the extra mile to make sure that it got done.
Well, I think it's the agenda that for the present president, anything that was associated with the previous president oftentimes was kind of shoved out the door.
You know? Well, and I, you know, hey, I am, I guess, I don't know if fan's the right word, but I see a lot of really good things that happen because of the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
But if I'm not mistaken, it was during the Obama administration that they did not continue to take action on. It was actually George Bush who read the book and right. listened to Anthony Fauci and said, we need a commission. Could this happen? And they said, yes. And they established a commission and work was done over a period of years. But sometime in the second Obama administration or right before he left, it all ended. And of course it wasn't going to be refreshed by, you know, who.
Right.
So,
who doesn't have the use for George W.
I know. So, I mean, I think there were people who in our government, in our structures who identified it, but this loose association, I've dealt with it actually back when the Ebola scare happened.
Yeah.
We all had to begin, you know, we had one patient get in the United States. Well, then boom, we had to, everybody was screening for Ebola, but you follow the state health department. Each state follows the state health department's guidelines. So, you know, CDC is this recommending body that everybody looks to, but then it's up to each state. And so and I realized with Ebola, that was our situation, and we should have been working on this long before. So in 100 years from now, I think there will be a puzzlement as to why we didn't follow through with working on it. And I think there'll be an assessment of the people, the states that did relatively well and did the right things and those that didn't.
Yes, I think you're right.
So,
well, now with the vaccines being given, and certainly in a few months when people are vaccinated, maybe we've developed herd immunity, although I don't know if those anti-vaxxers are going to keep that from happening or not. What do you think the new normal is going to be, Cynthia?
I think there'll be a time period. I kind of look at it as it's going to be a lot like the flu and the expectation of flu vaccine. In terms of like mandated by healthcare organizations and things like that, we don't know how long the immunity is going to last. We don't know if it's going to be an annual vaccine or long, you know, all that stuff. But I think for a while, the new normal is going to be, we're going to be accustomed to putting something on our cell phones, which we all carry around. There are real tracking devices, right? It doesn't need to be in a vaccine, like some people are, you know, conspiracy people are worried.
Yes, there's no microchips.
Right, it's here. We're all connected to them, and so I think it'll be common and expected that we'll show evidence that we have immunity. I don't think we'll be without masks until later, probably into the summer. And I wonder, we used to sort of be a little snide or snicker at our Asian friends who in very congregate, very population dense cities would be in public transportation, be wearing masks, and we'd say, oh, gee. And now I think, you know, flu's really down so far. The flu's down this year because we are social distancing. We're wearing masks. We're not around each other to let it spread. So I think perhaps we'll adjust our behavior or our practices. Maybe we'll get a little more considerate of people. And if we're not feeling well, we'll wear a mask. It'll be interesting to see how that evolves, but I think it'll just become the expectation. And, you know, we didn't question after a while that you needed a polio vaccine.
Exactly.
you
smallpox
know,
either.
smallpox vaccine, polio vaccine.
Yeah.
And I think it's only been in the last 10 or 15 years that I've really noticed the people who are anti-vaccine, or, you know, they want a kinder, gentler vaccine schedule and not so many given right away. My daughter and son-in-law, they, you know, it's like, if you want to see the baby, you got to tell us you've had your flu vaccine. Yes. So, it's, and people in the family who had not had flu vaccines before got them.
Yeah.
So, I think it'll become very, I think we'll be accustomed to showing our evidence of immunity and it will just become integrated into our vaccine schedules and, you know, we'll move on.
This has been a wonderful session. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
No, no, I think I've talked enough.
Well, it's been wonderful. It's been a very good interview. I really, really do appreciate it. And if you've got any other connections to nurses, or especially Glenn, is Glenn with Glenn Funeral Home?
Yes, his name is Glenn Taylor. It's a family. Okay. It's been a family funeral facility in Owensboro for many, many, many years. So I'll.
Yeah,
I'm
from Owensboro, so I'm very.
Oh yeah,
familiar.
Yeah, you have. That's I forget. Yeah, yeah. Actually, I have a friend who's very good friends with them personally. He will know who I am, so that if I say, I'll just reach out and see if he would be willing to participate in the oral history project with you.
I really do appreciate that. It'll be a vital story. And your interview was wonderful. Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Okay. Well, thanks. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you too. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Good night.